Jesus last time. And so we're going to start today with the beginning of Jesus' ministry. We talked about John's ministry and all it involved. And so this is the beginning of Jesus' ministry. And so with that, again, for those who haven't been here, I'll talk about what we're about to read. I'll add some things to it, and then we'll go back and read the actual accounts. So the first disciples, and I'm not talking about him actually officially making his disciples, but just where he first meets them. This will come from John chapter 1 when we get there. But on the day following John's testimony that Jesus was the Christ, if you remember when we talked about how John said that he was the Christ, John was standing with two disciples. And we'll call them disciples. They're not disciples just yet, but they're going to be. But standing with two disciples when Jesus walked by. And John pointed him out and said, "Behold, there's the Lamb of God." And this was sufficient for these two disciples who were with John. John had been announcing the coming of one greater for quite some time, and now this person had arrived. And so they immediately began to follow Jesus. Just following behind him. Again, perhaps knowing the greatest of Jesus from John, they did not speak to him. They simply followed him behind Jesus. Jesus eventually, as we're going to see, turns around and he asks what it is that they want, what they seek. And again, they've not yet to meet Jesus personally yet. They addressed him as a teacher, probably from what they'd heard from John. With this, they're humbly asking Jesus to instruct them, and they wish to know where they might go to receive that instruction. As a side note, we'll note, too, when we read it, the fact that the book of John interprets the word rabbi shows that John's target audience might not be familiar with Hebrew. We talked about how Mark writes to certain people, Matthew writes to certain people. But we'll notice that John says rabbi, but he also defines it because his audience may not be Jews. It was late in the day, it was about 4 o'clock our time, in the afternoon. So Jesus invites them to follow him and see where he's staying. And they remain there the rest of the day with him, though little of the day was left. We learn that one of the two who came to Jesus was named Andrew. We'll see that, which of course leaves us wondering who the other one was. Most likely answer is it's John. In my past lesson we talked about the book of John. John never mentions himself by name. He always says the disciple whom Jesus loved, but he never does mention himself. So it's most likely John. However, his presence, again, is implied in his detailed knowledge of the events. He even recalls the hour of the day, so again, most likely John. Andrew's conversation with Jesus, and combined with John's testimony, John the Baptist's testimony, convinced him that Messiah had truly come. And so he went to his brother Simon. Andrew goes to Simon and told him of what he'd found. And he brought him to Jesus. And it was probably that same evening. Simon's name means unloved or hated. Others translate the name as meaning fearful or timid. But Jesus said he would be called Cephas or Peter in the Greek, which means a stone or rock. And so here Jesus demonstrates power beyond men. He knew Peter's he knew both Simon's name. He knows his father's name, and greater, he gives him a name which he would be more suitable for him later in life. So in other words, at the meeting, Jesus knew Simon's current and future character. And so this demonstrates this to Simon. Notice that Simon, when we read it, accepts and begins to use this name immediately. He doesn't wait. On the next day, begin journeying toward Galilee, and they meet Philip. Philip was from Bethsaida, and it's the same hometown as Andrew and Peter, as we'll find out. Bethsaida is on the north edge of the Sea of Galilee, if you think about your maps, on the north side, the north edge of the Sea of Galilee. Since people traveled together for safety, it's logical that others from Galilee area would also join them for a long journey. Philip, in turn, finds Nathanael. Nathanael's other name appears to be Bartholomew, which means son of Ptolemy. John, the book of John, consistently calls him Nathanael, but the other writers of the Gospels call him Bartholomew, so note that. While Philip is from Bethsaida, Nathanael is from Cana. Let's turn to John chapter 21 and see where Nathanael's from. John 21 and verse 2. Simon Peter, it's just listening to the apostles here, Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana, in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, and so forth. And so we see where he's from by reading a different verse. Philip is also convinced that Jesus is the one prophesied by the Scriptures, and he excitedly tells Nathanael that Jesus of Nazareth is the one from whom the nation of Israel has been looking for a long time. Nathanael is not particularly impressed, as we'll see. Nazareth is not a town from where you would expect a great king to come from. Nathanael, again being from a neighboring town, was particularly unimpressed by someone who calls himself from Nazareth. However, Philip insists that he see for himself. And notice how often when we read, people are not asked to accept another's statement, but they're also always told, come and see. Go see for yourself whether something's true. That's a good rule of thumb. Jesus greets Nathanael in a very unusual way, we're going to see. He declares to those around him that he's an honest man. Jesus calls him an Israelite indeed. Or here was a man who actually deserves to be called Israelite, so he knew his character. But how could he? He's never met him before. Nathanael doesn't deny the assessment that he's Israelite indeed. Instead, he's puzzled on how a man he doesn't recall meeting can possibly know his character. And Jesus tells him that before Philip found him, Jesus saw him under the fig tree. And again, by saying he saw him, Jesus is not claiming to have physically seen him necessarily, but he's seen him as God sees all. He knew he was there. And the wording is also a bit odd. It's common for people to sit under the foliage of a fig tree. So it's nothing really unusual if Jesus called him out on this. But Jesus didn't say he saw Nathanael under a fig tree, but under the fig tree. So it's possible, most likely, that something notable happened under that particular tree that Nathanael remembered. But how could Jesus be aware of it? But Nathanael is startled that Jesus knew that he was certain no one else could have known this. So Nathanael jumps to the logical conclusion that this man must be deity. He must be this long-awaited king. Otherwise, how could he possibly know? He assures him that greater things will be seen that would confirm what Nathanael now knows. In particular, Jesus states that they would see into heaven and see God's angels coming and going to Jesus. Let's turn to John chapter 1 and read our scripture here. John chapter 1, and we'll begin at verse 35. The next day, again, John was standing with two of his disciples, and he looked at Jesus as he walked by and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." The two disciples heard him say this, and they followed Jesus. Jesus turned and saw them following and said to them, "What are you seeking?" And they said to him, "Rabbi," which means teacher, "where are you staying?" And he said to them, "Come and you will see." So they came and saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. One of the two who heard John speak and followed Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first found his own brother, Simon, and said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which means Christ. He brought him to Jesus, and Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, the son of John. You should be called Cephas," which means Peter. Again, how did Jesus know this? The next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now, Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." And Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" And Jesus answered, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." And Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." And Jesus answered him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." So again, Nathanael makes this statement right after he says, "I saw you under the fig tree." Something had to happen that he knew that Jesus knew he was there. It was something unusual. Any questions or comments about that section? Next, we're going to talk about the wedding in Cana. We're going to see that 3 days after leaving Bethany beyond the Jordan, Jesus and his disciples, and again, they're not really disciples just yet, per se. He's not officially called them, but they are following him. They arrive in Cana in time for a wedding feast. Jesus, his mother, and 5 disciples are all invited to attend this feast. Weddings were big celebrations in those days. They're different than nowadays. They typically lasted a whole week. Let's turn to Judges and see some examples of that. Judges chapter 14. Again, nowadays we get dressed up, we go, we're done, we eat, and we go home. 14 and verse 12. Samson said to them, "Let me now put a riddle to you. If you can tell me what it is within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes." Verses 17 and 18. She went before him the 7 days that their feast lasted. And on the seventh day he told her because she pressed him hard. And she told the riddle to her people. And the men of the city said to him, "On the seventh day before the sun went down, what is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion?" So forth. We see the example of how long those last. But it's likely or possible that Mary was related to the couple who were being wed, which would explain why she was not married, why she was there in the first place. She's in Cana. Since Joseph is not mentioned, and Mary is simply referred to as Mother of Jesus, it's most likely that Joseph has already died prior to Jesus' ministry at the age of 30. Even with the best of plans, as we know, things go wrong. And so before the feast ended, they ran out of wine for their guests, as we're going to see. Mary must have been involved in some way with catering the feast, because when they ran out, she brings it to the attention of her son, the wine. Why she told him and what she expected of Jesus to do about the situation, if anything, we really don't know what she expected of him. But there's not enough information, again, in the account to draw a conclusion of that. We only know that she knew he would do something to help, because she told the servants to do as he asked. We'll see. Jesus' response to Mary is not one of disrespect. How many times did Jesus call her woman? In our language today, it sounds kind of harsh. But he frequently addressed those of the female gender as woman. Let's go and turn over to Matthew chapter 15 and see some examples of this. Matthew 15, verse 28. Jesus answered her, "O woman, great is your faith. Be it done as you desire." John chapter 4. Verse 21. Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father." John chapter 19. Verse 26. And this is an example, by the way, as well as John not referring to himself as John. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." And then finally, chapter 20 and verse 13. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They have taken away my Lord. I do not know where they have laid him." So it was a common term. But here Jesus is gently reproving his mother for attempting to direct what he's to do or what he's not to do. What Jesus would do would come at its own time, and he knows this. Technically, the matter of food supplies is not a big concern of the guests, such as Mary, or himself. Nor was it time for Jesus' claim to be the Messiah to be publicly manifested. Here then we learn that Mary's request was more than it seems on the surface. Perhaps she was wanting him to declare himself. She knew who he was. But Jesus rebukes her and says, "Not yet. It's not time yet." Still, Mary understood that Jesus was indicating that he would take some kind of action in this matter. And Jesus, while giving aid, did so, but not in an intrusive way. Jesus has the servants, as we see, fetch water to fill 6 stone water pots. These pots were placed in the feast so that guests could wash their hands before eating. Mark chapter 7. Verse 3. Let's start verse 1. Now when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, they were unwashed. Verse 3, for the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. Again, we know that they wash their hands and so forth. There were large pots holding about 20 to 30 gallons. So think about the size of that. Think about a gallon of milk. And here we have 20 to 30 gallons apiece. There's six of them. Jesus then told the servants to draw a portion back out of the pots and bring it to the governor of the feast. Notice that Jesus does not physically take part of this. He doesn't participate in this process. He just tells them. And also notice that the people there were not aware of what he was doing besides the servants who he's talking to. It's like everybody knows. And Mary knows, of course. We find out later that the disciples became aware of it, of what happened as well. So they learned this, but it's later. By Jewish custom, a man was given the job of running the feast. Someone's assigned that job. He makes sure the food and the drinks are available and the Jewish dietary laws, which are significant, were being met. He coordinates who ate and when they eat, as well as scheduling of the entertainment. He's the postmaster, if you will. It's part of his duties to sample the food, make sure it's as it should be. It's fit for the guests. A simple reading indicates that Jesus made between 120 and 180 gallons of wine. That's a lot. It's a large quantity, even for a feast in a small town. Nor was the wine made at the start of the feast, as we know. They ran out sometime into the feast. It was made toward the end, as we'll see. John tells us that this miracle was the first miracle to be performed, which demonstrates his power. It reinforces the disciples' confidence that they have indeed found this Messiah. Now, some people have talked about and wonder, did Jesus do any miracles when he was a child? Well, this tells us no. This was his first one. This statement, again, proves those speculations is false. If there were earlier miracles, then this one in Cana would not be his first, as it's told. Let's read the text. John chapter 2. Begin verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were six stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification. That's that hand washing we talked about. Each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." And so they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in it. Questions or comments about that section? Next, we'll go to the cleansing of the temple. And notice Jesus has not called his disciples yet. That's down the road. We'll get to that later. He's met a few of them. But from Cana, Jesus, Mary, and the disciples went to Capernaum. Now think about this too. Even though they went north, the Bible mentions that they went down. Why is this? It's because of the elevation. Capernaum is 600 feet lower than Cana. And it's these subtle references which demonstrate the care and accuracy of the Bible record. They went north, but they actually went down in elevation. That's why it said they went down to Capernaum. They did not remain there very long at Capernaum before the time of the Passover came. And Jesus traveled with his disciples to Jerusalem after that. The account that is here recorded should not be confused with a similar incident recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We'll cover that later. Those things happened near the end of Jesus' ministry. This happened at the beginning, toward the beginning. Approaching the temple, Jesus finds people there selling livestock for sacrifices, and they're also exchanging money. People traveling from distant lands could not easily bring livestock for sacrifices. The old law allowed for an exchange to take place. Turn to Deuteronomy and see where this is granted. Deuteronomy chapter 14, begin at verse 23. Before the Lord your God, in the place that He will choose to make His name dwell there, you should eat the tithe of your grain, of your wine, and of your oil, and the firstborn of your herd and flock, that you may learn the fear of the Lord your God always. And if the way is too long for you, so that you're not able to carry the tithe, when the Lord your God blesses you because the place is too far from you, which the Lord your God chooses to set His name there, then you shall turn it into money and bind up the money in your hand and go to the place that the Lord your God chooses and spend the money for whatever you desire, oxen or sheep or wine or strong drink, whatever your appetite craves. And you shall eat there before the Lord your God and rejoice, you and your household. For a similar reason, people traveling from foreign countries would also have foreign coins. Turn to Exodus chapter 30. So they're there selling livestock. There's also money changers there. What's a money changer? Why need a money changer? We often see it when we go to foreign countries. You've got to change over to pesos or whatever, so you can use it there. Verse 13, Exodus 30 and verse 13. Each one who is numbered in the census shall give this, half a shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel is 20 gerars. Half a shekel is an offering to the Lord. So it says according to the shekel of what? The sanctuary. So again, people traveling to foreign countries would have these foreign coins. The Jews would. But the Jews took this verse here, and it's teaching to mean that only temple currency could be used. And so it requires what? You need a money changer. Let's change that currency. The old law did not imply that these exchanges were to take place at the temple, though. Of course, merchants granted the right to make trade rights in the temple courts would be guaranteed that good business. It's likely that they were charging premiums for this. The purpose of God's laws was to remove the burden from the worshiper. It wasn't an opportunity to make profit, but that's what they were doing. They were taking advantage of this. Jesus makes a whip of cords, drives out the merchants as well as the livestock, and he tells them that God's house is not a place to make profit. And such remains a concern. 1 Timothy chapter 6, nothing's changed. People today still try to make profit off God. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 5. Constant friction among people who are depraved in mind and deprived of the truth. Imagine that godliness is a means of gain. The fact that the merchants so readily gave place to Jesus, in other words, they didn't really put up a fight, indicates, at least when it's not recorded that they gave a fight, indicates that they knew that they were doing was dishonest. They knew better. The disciples found Jesus' action as further proof. Again, this is the Messiah we've been waiting for. They recall the words of David. Let's turn to Psalms 69. And verse 9. This will come up in our reading. For zeal for your house has consumed me, and the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me. But they found that this well described what Jesus was doing. Others demanded that Jesus show evidence that he had the right to determine who should and who should not be in the temple area. To their way of thinking, only a divine directive could permit such an action, and they didn't see him as divine, people who were against him. Past reformers of religion, such as Elijah, as we know, demonstrated their authority by showing miraculous signs that showed that they were acting on behalf of God. And the Jews were demanding the same thing from Jesus. Prove who you are. What authority do you have? The proof, Jesus stated, as we'll see, will be seen in his resurrection 3 days after his death. He chose not to state it clearly to those people who were demanding that he prove what he already knew was proper. As we know, he also speaks in parables a lot. Some understand and some don't. But he didn't want them to understand at this time. John makes sure that his readers understood what Jesus meant by it, though. But even the disciples, again, didn't understand at the time. No one did. We have the benefit of having the written word on this side of the cross here that we can understand. Yet his words were not clear to them until after Jesus rose from the dead. then his disciples understood. They also recalled statements from the Old Testament that hinted at the same evidence. Psalms chapter 16. And again, as we know, there's a lot of things that Jesus taught his disciples at the time. They just didn't get it. Verse 10. For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, or let your Holy One see corruption. Of course, it's during his resurrection. The Jews there, however, thought that Jesus was referring to the temple when he talked about that, not his body. The temple is structured that it, in its current form, it took 46 years to build. I turned 46 this year, so it took that long. How they scoffed. Could anyone claim to be able to rebuild the temple in 3 days? It was a point that annoyed them for years. They even brought it up as his crucifixion. Matthew chapter 27. They remembered his words from early on. Matthew 27, verse 40. While he's being crucified, and saying, "You who destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross." So here they're mocking him. They remember what he said, and they didn't like it. But Jesus remains in Jerusalem for the Passover feast. And we'll also be taking note of these early, of these yearly attendances. When it says he's there for the Passover, how often did the Passover happen? And so we know by how many Passovers he attended, by how many years he was on this earth during his ministry. But these are markers of the passing years. Since this Passover came shortly after Jesus' baptism, it marks the beginning of Jesus' first year of teaching. While in Jerusalem, Jesus begins to give signs, meaning that he performs several miracles in the presence of people. He's starting to let people know who he is. And these signs cause people to believe that he was the Messiah. John chapter 20. Again, we've seen his first sign with the water to wine, and he does other things. 20 and verse 30. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. While people put their confidence in Jesus, turn back over to John chapter 2 for a second. This will be from our reading. That we will know something. So again, people start to put their confidence in Jesus in verse 23. Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when what? When they saw the signs that he was doing. Even though they did this, Jesus does not put his confidence back into the people. Verse 24. But Jesus on his part did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people. The word entrust or commit here in verse 24 is the same word translated believe in 23. Jesus knows the hearts of men and he understands how fickle that man can be. And he didn't need for anyone to explain this to him because why? He was God. He knows their hearts since he was the creator. So Jesus does not discuss any of his plans at this time with his new followers. In fact, Jesus' encounter with Nicodemus, as we'll see in John 3 when we get there, illustrates his reluctance to reveal too much this early in his ministry. With that, let's read the script. John chapter 2, verse 12 again. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples. And there we also see that he did have brothers. Some people deny that. And they stayed there for a few days. The Passover of the Jews was at hand. And Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of trade." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." So the Jews said to him, "What sign do you show us to do doing these things?" And Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews then said, "It is 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking about the temple of his body, and John tells us that. We as readers know that. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. And when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs of what he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man. Questions or comments about that? We'll go and stop there.